something like it.
Well, I hope he makes a lot of money. Brad will still have it, doesn't he?
Yeah. And he's got some rather tight restrictions on obviously being a fella. We had the lots on the market at listed for a listing period of a couple of years ago, and the restrictions were so severe that it was, we didn't get them sold. It was pretty difficult.
Well, you've got a lot of land there. I mean, there's 20 acres, 18 acres of woods, and then about 102 acres of farmland.
He had, I think it was subdivided into four buildable lots back in the woods, south of the road. And then there was one that was built in the open on the brow of the hill that was built.
Well, that was built for his daughter.
What was that?
But I think it's been sold.
It's been sold several times.
You know somebody out there named Vogel?
Joe's sister.
Are they right?
What?
Is Joe's sister named Vogel?
No.
Is that Ruth?
Ruth.
Oh, then she's... Do you recall any of the Grange Wildwood church services that they had out there at the cabin? Every so often they'd have a... Oh, about twice a year, they'd have a church service.
I think this was a Y service. I don't remember why.
Was it Y?
The Grange didn't have any association or any affiliation with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, then this was Y, and they'd get different people to do the sermon and do the service and have a big potluck, and
yeah,
everybody'd come out to the cabin. And
this was just an ongoing thing as far as your community activity and self-entertainment. Initiating programs.
And it's still happening. About once a year.
Where? Where do they have it now?
You have that program?
They haven't had in the woods, I don't think, for several years. Because we sold the farm and I don't have any connection there, really. They have it over at Lee Park. They had it at Lee Park for a couple of times.
Is that Leeson's Park?
No. South of Clinton Highway 76.
Well, we've got some photographs of those, of at least one time there, because I was sitting in the front row, and I can remember those frequently going over there.
Have you spent time with Fanny on this?
Yeah, we've got Fanny on tape, and she's talked some about that, and somebody moved the little organ out there, and she would play it. She talked some about the cabin. And Roy's work and so forth, and described the two different cabins.
Yeah,
so we got that from her point of view, too. But of course, the more interlocking stories you get, the richer is my understanding of it, and the better I can write it up when I come to write that part of it up. And then, of course, if I can get a trail of a story to go with it, why, all the better. Yeah? Been told.
I'll turn it off.
Well, you might as well tell her because I'd like to hear her too.
I'm just reminiscing when your dad bought this farm.
Yeah.
Which was the Schneid farm.
Peter Schneid is our
father. There were several brothers involved, I guess.
Uh huh.
I don't remember the details as far as ownership. But anyhow, your dad became interested in all when he bought it. And he came back from firming up the transaction. He busted into the office and said, well, bought a farm. Surprised what you can do without any money. So the leverage in real estate has been going on for a long time.
Well, you thought that one shouldn't be taped?
Well, not necessarily.
Well, I've got a story about Grandpa buying the Hill Farm. And he wrote to his friend Jay Green, banker friend Jay Green, and said, I have a chance to buy 120 acres, and it's pretty well run down. Got a good enough barn, the house needs repairs, but they want $60 an acre for it. And I could see $50 an acre. I could farm that and come out on a $50 an acre, but I really can't see $60. And I don't know where that those letters are, but I remember perfectly seeing Jay Green goodbye. He says, I think purchasing farmland in this area is a sound proposition, and I don't think it would possibly go wrong if you go to $60 an acre. It's like for the
hill farm. For
the hill farm. Mm-hmm. Finally sold it for $750. That's what I got from the grand.
Yeah, well, of course, you brought it back to what it
and the house, and this poor old couple living in the house, I don't remember their name, we were just shivering about a little wood stove in the kitchen. Both of them all doubled up. Then I remember beating the waltzes to get the Obeck part. I think I even chased Lee Millington at the hospital. Get it. Okay. And when I paid $4.50 for that part, I thought
that was a free pump.
Speculative style.
Do you remember the Farm Progress days out here when they had it? I was not able to get to it. 61, I think it was. Fall of 61.
Right. You had our AFS in Germany. And you had Chief White Eagle or somebody came and they did Indian dance and native costume.
Had somebody come down from the Dells?
Yeah, we had an Indian come down from the Dells.
Where was your AFS student from?
From Germany.
So he came out and saw the Farm Progress days and
yes.
The...
He asked if I...
stayed out of school.
That was one day when I had met Aldrin. I believe he was having the ag school at that time, high up in the hierarchy of the ag school. I knew him quite well, and I said, why don't you come and have lunch with us? We were having lunch, and we were by ourselves, and we just wanted to have you come. He said, well, I'd like to, but I have a friend, and I said, well, bring the friend along. He said, all right, I will do that. He turned up with Gaylord Nelson.
Is that so?
So Governor Nelson had dinner up here, huh?
Yeah.
Lunch up here?
Yeah.
During Farm Progress days?
Say something you'd be interested in, Ron. North of Prairie du Sac. Why, they just built a regional U.S. facility for the testing of forage crops. Something that guys, but it's also very much involved in the development of breeding practice. And it's a place, they've got 1,300 acres, which was part of the Badger Ordinance, and the land was there and was available, so there's influence, I suppose, on getting located there. And they've got about a $3.5 million investment in it now, just for the farms and equipment for operating it. And they will be, I think, run pretty much under the labor at the University of Wisconsin. The laboratories, of course, they got Madison. It's just a combination. they're starting out with 60 great heifers, which they're implanting, so that they'll get about three or four calves a year out of the mother versus the seed.
I hadn't realized that had gotten so far along. You know,
it was an operation. It was dedicated this fall, and we knew about it, watched it, and we went to the dedication. And it's very impressive. It's something that when you know you see the size of it, the investment. Well, you think first, well, this is a lot of money to pour down the drain, but when you consider that. What has been done in the past, and what facility they have here to move into the future.
Rock Prentice was very much interested in ovary transplant, and he had a $500,000 setup, mouse laboratory and veterinarian arrangements, but at that time it meant anesthetizing the cow. And a major operation to get a hold of the ovaries and then implant them into host cows. But he had three calves, so conceived. But I thought that the thing had more or less in the background now, but I've been reading just recently some work that's being done.
Well, this is called a forage development. So we're experimenting, developing feeding practices, I suppose types of plants and so forth. But the whole phase of food and animal development, the more efficient dairy operation.
And are they getting the good cow to ovulate more? They can.
Well, you see, you can get the equivalent of four calves a year out of a good cow this way. Mm-hmm. Because the host cow actually.
She's the test tube for the test.
Well, is the test cow impregnated herself?
No. The great heifers are impregnated.
I mean, the impregnated ovary, the impregnated egg. It's put into their ovary. Well, that's what
it's
we were
put
doing.
Into their uterus.
Uterus.
Yeah.
That's what we were doing. But you can get 60 eggs out of a cow at one ovulation. So I don't see why they don't.
That's what I don't know about. Maybe they are.
I mean, they were getting.
Well, instead of getting daughters of high producing cows, why they're not going about that way? He's taking 60 great heifers and putting them in there and using the fertilized egg, I suppose, out of the high producing cow.
And put it in the great heifers. Well, that's what we were doing. That's what we're doing.
Well, it'd be interesting to find out the details of that operation.
It was a major operation.
And, well, I don't know anything about it.
And we were getting super ovulation. Instead of releasing two or three eggs at a time during an ovulation, by feeding them sheep hormones of some kind. I don't know what whereabouts I got them on the sheep, but they got these glands from Oscar Mayer and got them into the cow, so that they were getting super ovulation. But I remember the conclusion was that a cow would only have about so many eggs in her. In her body anyway.
Take them out too fast, she didn't last long.
Yeah, she didn't last long. But the reason that Rock gave it up was that it was such a long process and his money was tied up in all that he could beg, borrow from relatives or anybody else in this freezing of semen and expanding ABS. And this was such a long-range proposition. He had a $500,000 laboratory that he built just for one man, Dr. Lue, a man from some monastic order in Switzerland, I was working at the Washington University. Is that the Catholic University in St.
Louis? Louis, I think so.
And all he was getting there was
maybe at St. Louis University.
Nominal salary, and he had the prospect of going back to Switzerland when he got older and washed dishes in this monastery. And somewhere or other, a rock worked out in Ramus so that he could come to Madison, and Rock bought a house on Lake Mendota, three stories high, rebuilt the whole thing, Swiss chalet type of thing, put a telescope on the roof, special operation, and gave Louis this this laboratory to work in, and full operation there. And he's one of the few authorities, now dead, but he was one of the few authorities in the world on freezing live tissue. And the first time I heard him was when I went to a meeting in Chicago that Rock had called for people all over the United States, had men, and Louis was one of the speakers. And one of the smart alecks in the group says, Dr. Louis, could you freeze a man? And Dr. Louis said, yes, if you could slice him thin enough. Then after Rock had him hired, and he was sitting in with about 8 or 10 of us from ABS, he was talking about stresses. And he said that, you know, that if you take an egg, you can take an egg, and if you hold it right in your hand and press on a certain point on both top and bottom of the egg, you can't break it, no matter how hard you push. He got so excited with his story that he called the waitress and had to bring him a raw egg. So here he is at the head of the table, guest of honor. So he got up like this. He got his egg placed in his hand and right so forth and so on. And he started putting on the pressure, and all of a sudden, bang!
All over himself
and everything.
Got carried away.
Yeah. Well, that didn't faze him. He called for another egg and put the right stresses on it and proved his point.
Yeah, that's.
But.
Now who's standing on the road?
Of course, the thing in this ovulation, this implanting. Impregnated eggs. There's a hope that you could reach into the cow sometime and just suck them out like, or pull them out like you could pull peas out of a pod, you see. And then fertilize them outside the cow
and plant them in scrub cows.
And they were a long way from that technique. And
that's what they're doing. As I understand it. When I was there on the opening day, I don't remember that we saw any cattle there. I think they had, as they said, 60 heifers out pasture there, just great heifers. And they intend to have a herd of about 350. And they've got all the barns, all the facilities. It's just a maze of sweeps and so forth on it.
Well, it'll do the same. It'll do for the female side of the family what
the artificial insemination
has done for the male.
That's exciting. Have you been up to the Ford Museum up at Fond du Lac?
No.
Fort Atkinson?
Yeah.
I'd like to go up there. I haven't been there.
Very interesting. I can't think of the lady's name. Incidentally, I got involved in publishing a book.
You did?
Yeah.
What sort of book?
Well, this is a book on the history of Boy Scouting in the Council area. Mm-hmm. Martin Kruger, a friend of ours, PTA, and so forth. Your dad knows him. Martin had a heart attack about 6 or 7 years ago and worked with Bendix, an engineer. Very precise, thorough. Dedicated surrender guy in his way. And so he had to take early retirement, and he started recovering his heart attack. And after a few months of that, well, he was just beside himself, up on the roof. And so he had to do something, so he
his interest at that time would be primarily, not primarily, but to the greatest degree, was scouts. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of pictures and so forth. He started to make a scrapbook, and that was fun. And the thing went on, and a couple of years ago, I had gotten this idea of publishing a book. And it's rather limited, you know, opportunity for the sale of that particular area, because it doesn't go very far as far as volume sales. And so he was ready to publish it, except that he had to have somebody to get behind him. And the council had been too interested. I just stopped in one morning visiting Larry Raymer. Larry was kind of complaining because the council wasn't taking money as seriously as they should. I was giving any encouragement, any support, and so forth. In fact, the guy's got John Deere up at Janesville, what's his name? Implement dealer at Janesville.
McNall?
McNall was president of the council at that time. And Larry says, this guy, McNaught, he says, he just turns me off. He says, I don't know the most great operators want to even listen to this. So, I know Dick, and I intimately, but I know him quite well. I've always liked him. I've always been well impressed by him. And Larry says, well, why don't you talk with him? So I reached over, picked up the telephone, and Dick was there, and he answered the phone. I sit with him, and talked about the book, and yeah, I guess so. And a couple weeks later, I got a card in the mail. And it said, we are having a committee meeting on the publishing of Martin Cougar's book. Meeting is 2 weeks or whatever. If you're interested, come. And at that point, she almost had to come.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, had interest in it. I worked with Hap Hornbostel on it. He's part of the committee. He's on the board now, and got the scout organization to get behind it. And got some law interest money to work with. And got a book out.
Terrific.
Just a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process, while you were playing with some of the people, who's Wisconsin Magazine publishes that. Bob.
Tales and Trails.
Tales and Trails, the guy that.
Mead.
Bob Mead, is that it?
Something like that.
And, you know, just looking for information and help. And anyhow, the book got published. And
it's been right around the whole time.
In the process, Hannah, I think is her first name, who's charge of the Port Museum in Port Atkins. Quite a lot of interest, and she came to some committee meetings, and we relied on her for some help. I guess she's been involved in a couple of publishings.
We have a copy of the magazine just nearby, Dad. We've been looking at it. I don't see it now.
So there's a lot of names and experience.
Here's my tape recorder, and I want to get Mother on tape telling me about making Joanne's formula with vegetable juice. Would you start in on that story again, Mother? When Joanne was little?
Right now?
Right now, on my tape.
Yes, well, when we got in touch with Dr. Mabel Daniels of Iowa State University, she was a specialist in children's diseases and formulas for babies and that section of work.
And why'd you get in touch with her?
And we got in touch with her through the Boutwells.
But why?
Because I was nursing my first baby, Joan, and I didn't have enough milk for her, so she had to have an extra bottle after feeding, but it didn't seem to satisfy her, and we were looking around with our Dr. Thayer trying to figure out what we should do to give her an extra amount of food, and it had to be given in a bottle until she was old enough to lean on vegetables only. But Mabel Daniel was very helpful and told us that this would be a good thing to do, to take 4 vegetables, 2 leafy and 2 other type, and boil them until they were all soft and able to be mashed through a sieve. The juice before the vegetables had been
juice that was poured off the vegetables.
The juice that was poured off the vegetables was to be used in the formula instead of water with the milk.
Mm-hmm.
So her bottle was milk and vegetable juice of 4 vegetables for quite some time, and it was a wonderful idea, and she thrilled mightily on that particular recipe, as it were. Then also, vegetables that were ready and soft and boiled, I put through a sieve on Miss Daniel's suggestion, and fed the baby
the mush, the pulp, the
the vegetable pulp that was
there wasn't Gerbers and things like that at that time. Well, the baby
there
food jars.
There were no baby food jars at all. Nothing like that, and so it took a long time every day for me to make the soup and to use the water from it, from the vegetables for the bottle. But I did it, and she would eat up the mush that was left, and she would have the water in the soup. In the milk for the bottle. Fortified water. So everything she got was full of good food and vitamins and...
Okay, now jump to your and Dad's idea to market it.
Well, we got along so well on that bottle with Joan that we told our doctor, Dr. Thayer, about it and how well that worked, and that the Boutwells, Dr. Boutwell was the head of the chemistry department of the college, how he had and his family had had such a good outcome or whatever for their babies, and in fact Dr. Bartwell was the one who told me about Mabel Daniels, and that they just swore by her, and she would help me, and that was how we got the word. And so all our children were raised the early years of their lives on Mabel Daniels' ideas of vegetable water and vegetable soup and vegetable puree and...
Well, get to your idea of
so
marketing
far.
It.
So, Ron and I thought that...
at the barn and put it in a
crate on the back of a single buggy and drove it up to Janesville, Grandpa and I. I think there were three pigs in the class. I forget whether I got a white ribbon or a red ribbon.
Well, I came along a little bit later. I don't remember what kind of a pig I had, but I had a Model T Ford that was about $5. But I took the pig to the fair. I just put the pig in the back seat of the car and put a gate over the top of it. I wired it down so the pig was there for keeps. And Model T Fords had a way of running out of gas. They had a gravity gas line. The gas tank was underneath the driver's seat. And when you went up a rather steep hill, the gas didn't run into the carburetor, ran the other way. So I got almost to Janesville, and the gas was too low to get me up the last hill. Well, this was simple. All you had to do was turn the car around and back it, because then the gas would run down in the engine. So I...
clever!
I took the pig to the fair in the back seat of the Model T, and the last hill as you go up across the prairie here, go across the railroad tracks and head up toward the fairgrounds is kind of steep.
It was a deep cut, and you went down and then you went up.
I backed the pig up the hill to make it on the gas that I had.
Of course,
that's a good story.
Another with the Model T Ford, when you wore the bands on it and you couldn't drive forward, you could turn around and drive backward because you didn't wear out your backing band as fast. So, yeah. I know I used to drive backward some of the time.
You gotta talk with Bob Maxwell.
Tell him I should talk with Bob Maxwell. Okay, he was he the sheriff for a while?
Well, yeah, he's the one that took care of my grandson Bart.
Well, was he the one then that was in the wire?
Turn it off, because you got this truck.
I'm just saying that Johnny says I should talk to Bob Maxworthy, so that'll be somebody I should talk to. Okay, Dad's going to tell a story.
Well,
this is a story about Bart, and I'm going to get it down because I might use it sometime, and I don't have it. Well, I've heard it before, but I don't think I have it on tape.
Well, anyway, Bart woke me up and told me he had this... a sign from with Les Aspin's name on it. Big sign with Les Aspin from Connie's. Well, I realized that I was recognized as a reasonably solid Republican. Of course, I thought I was independent because in 1936, I guess I voted for Roosevelt. But that was the end of my independence. And I told him that I wouldn't do anything that night, but it was pretty bad. And, I'd have to just decide to do something in the morning. So in the morning, before he was around, I called up Bob Maxwell, told him what had happened, told him I wanted to come over and give this kid the scare of his life. So Bob Maxwell, he drove in about 9:30 with lights flashing and siren going. I got Bart out, and actually gave a lecture, and he said, well, I tell you what I'll do. It's your first offense, and I don't like to have this on the record. It could go on the record and really be banned for the rest of your life. If you'll get that sign back, we won't do anything about it. So I got a little truck from Howard Lentell. And Howard and Bart and I drove the sign over there and put it up while the sheriff had his car parked by the side of the road. He was right across from the town hall. And here the siren was going every once in a while. And kids were working to beat the band. I think maybe they got a hold of Normington too. But what they'd done is to... go up there and dismantle the sign in the middle of the night and carry it across the field and down south of the town hall to the gravel pit where they put it on their car and got what they could in their car. And then they sneaked home with it and put it in the garage.
Well, kids don't change much.
What kind of a sign was it?
When Les Aspin.
Oh, Les Aspin.
and as a fairly good Republican, how much fun everybody would have had about how the depths with which a Republican will sink.
Say, so Jackie, one of the early memories.
Yeah.
Why we used to have Grange meetings. And before we had the regular electric power, right, we had these lighting systems. And they were a little gasoline engine with a generator, which generated about 24 volts of current. And you had lights, just like the alternator on a car. Mm-hmm. And they would have batteries that would store it. But to get any amount of usage, when you had to run the, it was a Delco, BBLCO. And so while they had the dignified Grange meeting, we used to have to entertain ourselves and didn't have much planned program for the kids. So we used to play tag and used to do lots of things. But we found out that where the exhaust came up from the Delco system in the basement, that you could shut the thing off if you could hang on to this exhaust muffler long enough to choke the engine. So we used to dare each other to straddle us and get a good tight hold. You usually put a handkerchief over your hand so it didn't burn too bad. You turn the lights off and choke it. And then the custodian, just you can work on that. Well, it isn't going to go off this time. Got the carburetor all cleaned out. Everything is just right. Middle of Grange meeting. And the Delco system.
And they wouldn't know it was you kids.
I don't think they ever knew what made it go off.
Well, that's a good story. That'll be fun to use. Are we moving? Yeah. Would you have been at those meetings? You might have been.
No, he was a little bit older. I can remember. Ron was not the. Ron was quite often in a hurry, especially when he was driving.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember one day watching him leave the hall and go south and come to the railroad station. Just at the last minute, decided he wasn't going to be able to make it in front of that train.
For gosh sakes.
And I don't remember what he was driving.
No, wait, you mean the driving south on East Collie Road there to those the Milwaukee Road tracks?
Well, we all watched because it was, you know, just a panorama view.
You could see right down
and
that little valley.
Your dad handled it very nicely. He brought the car in sideways right up to the railroad track and stopped.
Oh, good Lord, do you remember that?
Something to the other.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Turn it off, I'll tell John Stone.
The best ones are turn it off. On the way to school, which we had to walk a mile and a quarter or something like that, right? We went across the fields, it was a shortcut.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are always going to the shortcuts. But in the wintertime, we would track. We would set steel traps for animals. And along the creek, you might get a muskrat, of course, this season. Or you might get most anything that happened along a rabbit. Usually you didn't get the rabbit because their bones would break the leg off, get out of the trap. But one morning, I had a skunk. In fact, Bob Weller was a neighbor friend of mine. We used to run the traps together. Mm-hmm. So we'd meet at the creek and then we'd look at the traps on the way to school. And we had a skunk. This was, you know, really an accomplishment. But we didn't have any means of handling it. So we proceeded to bludgeon the skunk to death with a hammer. And we had to get it pretty close in order to get it back at it. By the time we didn't, you know, we just were oblivious to the fact that we smell like we did because we just sort of been with it so long. But we got to school, and after killing the skunk, it became a wonderful story to tell. And of course, they knew that we'd met a skunk before we ever got almost of within Savoy shot of them. So we never got into school house. We were very promptly turned around and sent home to get rid of all of the effects of that skunk accomplishment.
So say it wasn't Maxworthy, Bob Maxworthy, but it was Bub Weller that we used to have such a time with our playing.
I am. Bob was a little bit younger. Mm-hmm. Bob was a year older than I, and Bob was, I think, a year younger. Mm-hmm. He eventually married Ruby Hart.
I don't know. I didn't know that story. Do you want to say that briefly so we get it on tape? This is a light tractor.
Well, the evolution of power,
the
evolution of power farming was actually by the making mobile. The equipment that they had used originally on a stationary basis, and so in the process, while you were working with first a steam locomotive, which was a very massive, heavy piece of equipment, and then as they began to convert to gasoline-powered equipment, the gasoline engines were a single cylinder, and they were likewise massive because they had a degree of similarity in the construction with the construction of the steam engines.
Mm-hmm.
And so it used to be a problem because these were very heavy and they would be easily bogged down and stuck. They were very cumbersome to manipulate and to have for field work. And they were difficult and almost impractical.
Mm-hmm.
But my father's brother was very mechanically inclined and interested in gasoline engines and the use of them. And he got the idea of more or less substituting a small, lightweight gasoline engine powered molded type of equipment that would replace a horse or a couple of horses.
Mm-hmm.
And so he put together some machines that were just a hybrid machine out of whatever pieces of equipment that were available or that were usable, and made some small tractors that were lightweight, that were some of the forerunners of the present day light type tractor. And he spent his life working for International Harvester, International Harvester people, and he was very successful at it. Salary man and their patents, and being salary or ownership of the patents or forfeited his rights, his contract with the company. At one time when he was in charge of all of the truck service stations during the Depression, many of the dealers financially broke, and the company took over their garages and service stations, and he was charge on a national basis of the international repair shops and service stations.
Hmm.
And then in World War II, he was teaching at one of the service academies on the Northwest. He lived in Albany and taught out of Albany.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after World War II, he retired from the National Service.
Hmm.
Also, I'm sure that you have knowledge and material on the history of the work that Mr. Warner did here on the war, the invention work, the invention and production of the speedometer.
I've heard something about it. I haven't really collected it and got it in order because it.
Yeah, this would be available through the Historical Society.
Mm-hmm. I haven't, because that doesn't directly deal with the farm. The what does directly deal with it is the is the corn curls. Claire Matthews developed corn curls up in the round barn, working on feed for the cattle. Yeah. So there's that story. Do you recall any incidents with any of the men around the place, either at the time you were here or afterwards? I mean, you've told about, which one was it you said that was in, it was Veman that was in the Plum Cafe. Any of the other men that,
Ruby. Well, when we were on the route, so we just didn't spend time here.
So your time would be in your checking out or in your loading up or down at the Plum Cafe
that would be the time that would be associated with the point sale.
Mm-hmm.
Was Glenn Wallace here when you were here?
Glenn?
I was thinking about this tale of Glenn and another boy on the farm, rivals for the same girl. And
oh, Bill Purcell.
Bill Purcell.
Is that for Elmer?
No, I don't think so.
At any rate, one of the boys climbed into the back of a Ford. They have the rumble seat back thing that turned down.
Bill Purcell.
Now this is a good story. Go on, please.
Well, I John probably knows better than I, but anyway.
Well, mine on it. Let's get the facts.
Anyway,
as well as you can remember.
This Glenn Wallace, I thought it was, goes out and he realizes something's there in the back, under the back, and he thinks it's Bill Purcell. And anyway, he passes the back down and. Spends his evening with his girl, and then he takes her for a long ride around the country, and Purcell is curled up there and under that back seat, and can't get out, and can't make a noise.
Yeah, that I've forgotten just the fine details, but that's what happened.
That rings a bell with you, that's
he
story.
Had a pretty rough time.
When did he finally let him out, do you suppose?
Oh, I suppose he's probably... He was surprised when he opened the back end of the car. And
Josh, what are you doing here?
And they were both working on the dairy at the time?
Yeah.
And so he would have crawled in at the dairy and then
well,
be carried off?
Well, he crawled in. I don't know where he crawled in.
Uh-huh.
He was going to see what was going on anyway.
Well, that's a good story.
I have to tell you a personal story, Jack. He was really cool. You know, I always like that one. You know, you come out top man.
Good.
Top dog. Well... Lois and I were married while I was working in the buildings.
Uh-huh.
And we lived in the Demons' upstairs apartment, which they finished off the upstairs of their house into a small apartment. And we were the first.
This was the one right down there by the tracks?
Down to the tracks.
Okay.
We were the first occupants of
a lot of famous people lived in there.
And
Marston.
Frank Marston.
Frank Marston.
And we were the first occupants. Well, we had quite a neighborhood gang, having grown up in the neighborhood and worked around the neighborhood. And we used to go to public dances, and two or three nights a week, right, we'd go to different dance halls, Boston Hall, Little Beach, and go to public dances.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the process, over a period of several years, right, had you know, quite a few friends that gang around together. So we were married and got settled into the apartment, and we were chivalry, you know what a chivalry is.
Yeah, I never experienced one,
when
but I'd like to
your
hear
friends,
about it.
When all of your friends dropped in some evening unexpected and you treat them.
Uh-huh.
And they
turned off your lights and everything was quiet.
They usually vandalize a little bit, and hopefully nothing too serious. But we lived upstairs in the apartment, and there was a deck out over the garage in the back, which was over the garage area of the Demons. And so the chivalry went on, and the noise was made, and the people came in. I went off to town to get the treats, and everybody finally left giggling, and we didn't know what to be done. Usually, right, you had a bed to sleep in, or you were lucky, and from there on, things got worse. So they had, in the course of the evening, why, they had moved a lot of Roy's, garden equipment and possessions, and a wagon, among other things, up on top of the deck above his garage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was a pretty good trick. And so the gang left, but we didn't hear any cars start. And shortly afterwards, well, there was a knock on our door, and for our car keys. Well, we didn't have their car keys. We knew nothing about it. But Roy had the car keys. So he went out and directed the operation, and they had to take everything down and put everything back before they got their car keys to go home in the chivalry.
That was, you were at the farm at that point. You were working on the Dogan farm. And Roy was too then, wasn't he?
Sure.
I heard about a chivalry, a Turtle Township chivalry, and I think it was after I was married. Some couple kept waiting for the chivalry, and they had the treats all ready, and, you know, a week went by, and 2 weeks went by, and 3 weeks went by, and the chivalry didn't come. And finally, they gave up on the chivalry and decided it wasn't going to happen, and then it happened. And this whole gang of Turtle Township young folk came rushing in the middle of the night, and they had a couple of gunny sacks filled with either sparrows or pigeons that they had managed to catch, and they let them loose in the house. And I guess it was just one awful mess of getting those birds out and then cleaning up the mess that the birds made.
That sounds like Byron Beach's gang.
Did you ever hear about that one?
No, that was after hours.
Well, it might have been Byron Meach's gang.
I think it was the younger.
It might have been the late 40s or the early 50s. It might have. Not sure what group it was, but I heard
it has
about
a rural atmosphere, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to make a chivalry in the book, and so maybe I can put in yours and add in a few things from other chivalries. And that would be a good one.
Well, I can remember
beating on
one.
Pans?
I can remember one. Used to, usually start off by somebody shooting off a gun, 12-gauge shotgun. It's still a name, making up a lot of racket. But there was one that I can remember way, way back where they thought it was a better idea to use a stick of dynamite.
Oh.
Blew the windows out of the house.
Oh, good Lord.
that was Harry Reamer? I don't know whether it was Harry Reamer, it might have been Harry Chivalry, either that or his sister Chivalry, but it was up on the river farm.
But blew the windows out loud.
Well, not all of them, just all outside where the dynamite was.
You probably cracked them,
Rob.
You probably just cracked them. That's what it does.
Knife hunt when you were a kid? Was it Dad that got you snipe hunting?
Yeah, I remember. I remember.
Did you hold the sack somewhere?
What was it, a snipe hunt, or was it some kind of a treasure hunt? You laid out a treasure hunt. Laid out a treasure hunt for the Y boys one night. And it was a beautiful moonlight night along the late fall. And it was quite a variety of things, but I remember, as far as I was concerned, I ended up in a creek up to about a little bit above my belt buckle, you know, and just going from one place to another, and we had to find the next, whatever it was we had to find. And I was scooting along down here in the pasture, and I came to this level place where it looked like it would be easy to run, but that happened to be the creek. So I went off into the creek, and I spent the last part of the evening drying out because I was just soaked.
uh-huh. I remember.
That was a treasure.
I remember getting a great deal of pleasure the time or two or three that you speared suckers in the creek.
Well, that was one I was going to talk about.
Now, what's that? I haven't even heard about that.
You want me to tell
yeah,
you?
Yeah,
you talk,
let's hear it.
You can talk about it.
Well, in these small streams, why, I suppose it still happens, but the high water in the spring attracts the suckers, the fish, that will come up out of Turtle Creek or up out of the bigger streams, and they come into the small streams to spawn.
Mm-hmm.
And when the ice goes out and the water's high, why, they can get through the shallows and get up into the up further into the smaller creeks. Then when the water goes down, why, these large, maybe a foot, 14 inches long, which is big for these small creeks, these spawning suckers will be not trapped in there because the water is still flowing, but they will be pretty much in the deeper holes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we used to take flashlights at night and look in the shallows and the riffles of the creeks, mm-hmm. and then we would spear them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very sensitive and they spook very easily, so it was not always too productive, but it was a lot of fun. And Bob Maxer and I used to get organized together. We'd spear suckers at night. And your dad found out about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it attracted him. He was very enthused about it and wanted to go along. So he went with us. And you see the big fish in the shallows with a flashlight, but before you get near enough of a spear, to spear them, why they quite often be gone.
Mm-hmm.
But your dad got so excited about it that he just didn't wait for anything. He could see the fish in the shallows, or he'd just take off with his hands and try to catch them.
Did you ever catch one, Dad?
Well,
grabbing
sure.
it with your hands?
Sure.
That's a good story. And this would be down here in the creek below the dairy, even? And
no, this was usually, there's a bigger creek over further south, just south of the old Mexico.
There used to be something up by south.
We never speared them in here, because that wasn't our home territory.
Mm-hmm.
But the Otter Creek, we used to call it, the one south of the state line over in Illinois, and we used to have our best time suckers over there.
Was a sucker worth eating, or was it just the fun of trying to catch it?
No, they were good eating. They're something like they're a fish with a lot of fine bone.
But
the quality of the meat is good. The strength, the cold water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, those are a good time that I had with the boys.
Well, that would have been in your young married life then, right? 1925
you were married while you were running this Y group.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
you'd come back from Europe then, and you were married in Europe.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you were always married when you were with us.
But he was pretty young when he got married. You were almost 22. You were 21 on May the 3rd, and then on May the 10th?
May the
20th. I keep getting you mixed up with Grandpa. On May the 20th, he was 22.
He was old enough to be our leader.
Right.
Whatever that
meant. Well, after I'd been with you for a number of years, I got Roy interested in it.
Roy took over. Yeah, well, no, I think that he got the next batch. You got Phil and Byron and Glenn.
And they were the ones that built the Y cabin.
Well, we were in on the original. There were two Y cabins. We built the original.
Uh-huh.
And I think that they came along a few years later and rebuilt it. So I think we were married. Either that or we were close to being married at the time the Y cabin was built, because I think that was kind of a couple's project.
You mean the original? Or?
Yeah.
The original.
That was where the posts were all upright.
The first one had the posts upright.
Yeah. And then we outgrew that.